Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking turf today with Doug Soldat. He's a professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, specializes in turf grass, urban soils, nutrient management, soil testing, water resources, and landscaping irrigation. So lots to talk about there. Are you new, perhaps, to caring for a lawn? What questions do you have? Or maybe you've been doing it for a long time and some problems have developed. Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, we would love to see you, and if you've got some photos, too, you can send those along. Doug will be able to see them online, and so when you email, if you've got a photo you want to email of your lawn or a piece of it, shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org as well. Doug Soldat, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's so great to be back on the program, Larry.
Well, good to have you here. What are some, you know, I just... minutes ago, took a look at my own lawn. Looks kind of scraggly right at the moment. It's greening up, but what are some basic things we can do to improve our lawns?
Yeah, this is the first, you know, we have good weather coming up this weekend, so it's the first time I think people are going to be out there assessing the damage and the road ahead. Really, there's not a lot to do right now. If you've had, I would say, if you've had problems with crabgrass historically, we're approaching the time when applying a crabgrass preventer makes sense. Probably this weekend would be the earliest, and then up into the next couple weeks. There's a couple different ways to do that with conventional products, or alternative like corn gluten meal has been shown to be very effective at preventing crabgrass. But you don't want to fertilize, and so I think it's too early to think about fertilization. The only thing you should be doing now is kind of raking up the dead stuff with a lawn rake, thinking about that crabgrass preventer application if you've had trouble with it in the past.
Yeah, raking, that reminded me of dethatching. Is dethatching, or let's say, when is it necessary?
Yeah, that's a mistake I think a lot of people make this time of year, is they'll rent a power rake or a dethatcher, which has got these kind of spinny metal blades on it, and it really damages the lawn. It hurts it. It exposes the soil, and really what you see is a bunch of weeds having the opportunity to come up in that event. So thatch is a problem that is pretty rare on lawns. It's the brown stuff that you see now is really just dead leaves, and if you have a thatch problem, you're looking at kind of an inch of like really woody type material, not the soft dead brown stuff that all lawns have now.
Yeah, and that soft, dead brown stuff is essentially or eventually providing us with a little nitrogen, isn't it, for the lawn?
Yeah, exactly. It'll break down really easily once the temperatures get warm enough for the soil microorganisms to start feeding on it. So it'll go away. If you do rake that stuff up a bit, it does speed the green up and the warming of the soil. So you can rake it. I leave mine for what it's worth. Yeah. But yeah, you can rake it up with a leaf rake too.
Yeah, I leave mine too. Cindy in West Bend has a question. Let's go there. Cindy, hi.
Bought my house about 6 years ago, and I bought it in the winter, so I was real surprised when my lawn was very yellow way later than everybody else's, very distinctively more straw colored. So it greens up in the summer and it turns yellow earlier in the year than the other neighbors' lawns. And I've
Sounds
noticed
like
that the grass grows and it's like really short and it gets seeds on the top. It doesn't really ever get long, the weeds and stuff, so I still have to mow, but
Maybe zoysia grass? I don't know. What do you think?
Right. Yeah, it sounds like it could be zoysia grass, which is a warm season grass that can survive up here. The advice I usually give to people that have it is to sell your house in the winter. So I hope you didn't buy the house from a previous Garden Talk listener, because but you know, when I say that, and I probably get it this time, zoysia grass owners will email me outraged because they love their lawn because it's very low maintenance, and but yeah, they won't green up until about late May or June, and then they'll start to turn brown at the end of September. Because of their tolerance to temperature is a little bit different. So if you do have zoysia grass and you want to replace it, you're talking about just kind of a full-scale renovation, unfortunately. There's not a lot of kind of slow conversion you can do with that grass. I would be, you know, if you send me some pictures of it, I think the most important thing is to get a proper identification on it, and then we can hopefully give you some more detailed instructions from there.
Yeah, I think we have one zoysia grass lawn in our neighborhood, and it really kind of stands out. Cindy, thank you so much for. What if she wants to get rid of the whole lawn?
That's an option, and so killing the entire lawn with either a non-selective herbicide or some other method, and then preparing the soil and planting or sodding the desired grass is the way to approach that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dwayne in Wausau has a question too, so let's go there. Hi, Dwayne.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I have zoysia grass out in Dubuque, and they use that a lot in Florida and that because it's real resistant, like with Bermuda. But anyway, my question was, everything's a couple of weeks early, so I was thinking it was too late for pre-emergent, but it goes on soil temperature, right? And then I was going to put it down this week, and then grubs, you know, do you need to put on grub control, and when would be the best time? Do you go out and look for the little white maggots? And then
right.
I had sod webworms from these. I would mow, and hundreds of moths would come up in front of my push mower as I'm mowing. So I had to use an insecticide. And so three things there real quick. Thanks.
Sure, yes. A lot of stuff there. So crabgrass germination happens when soil temperatures start getting into the 55, 60 degree range. It's very difficult to eradicate once it germinates, so the approach is to use a pre-emergent herbicide that prevents it from germinating. The timing on that is, at least in southern Wisconsin, it's just starting to hit now. The optimum timing, though, is when forsythia bushes are in full bloom. So forsythia, these beautiful, bright yellow flowers that you see, one of the first things to bloom in the spring. It's a shrub. And so you look around your neighborhood and your community for those, and when you start to see a lot of forsythia in bloom, that's about the right time to do crabgrass. So like in southern Wisconsin, that's going to be 2 weeks before we see that in northern Wisconsin. And you want to get the timing right. So the other option is if you go to GDD Tracker, if you Google that, Growing Degree Day Tracker, GDD Tracker, it will actually show you a map of the optimum timings for crabgrass preventer, along with some other things. Moving on to your second question about grubs. So grubs, I treat grubs and crabgrass kind of the same. If I have a history of problems with grubs and crabgrass, then that's when I want to prevent them. But I don't think either of those are necessary if there hasn't been a history. So look, you want to prevent grubs when you know that you've had grub damage in the past. And the optimum timing for white grub control is usually around the 4th of July. But I do not recommend that everybody uses a grub preventer just because. In fact, I've lived in Madison for about 15 years now, and I've never treated for grubs, and I've never had grub problems in my lawn. So it's not definitely a thing that you need to do. And then with the webworms as well, webworms can chew on the grass and kill it. But a thing I'll mention is the most important thing for insect control is to get a proper identification. For example, there are lots of moths that will come up in front of my mower that aren't feeding on the grass. And just because we see a moth in the lawn doesn't mean that we want to necessarily attack it. So get it identified. We have a wonderful insect diagnostic lab here at the University of Wisconsin. We have a turf grass diagnostic lab. Get those pests identified and then use the proper control, recommended control option for them.
Yep. There you go. Good luck, Dwayne. Thank you so much. Good questions. Sandy in New Berlin, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning, Larry and Doug. I have a question about shady areas. We planted a beautiful maple tree in our front yard quite a few years ago, and the shade is getting more dense every year, and as a result, the grass underneath is getting more and more sparse. So my question really, Doug, is about timing for putting down patch seeding, and I know my husband's going to be chomping at the bit to do that this weekend because of the forecast for warm weather, and I don't know if I should discourage him or not, so I need your expert advice.
Yeah, that's great. So shade, maple shade is really tough, too. It's grasses didn't evolve in shade, and so very few of our grasses do really well in shade. And there's two components to the shade that are causing problems. Number one is the blocking of the light, but the second one is that maple tree is also competing for water and nutrients at the surface with those grasses. So I'm just going to say right off the bat, no matter what, you're going to have trouble growing healthy grass under a maple tree. So I always, you know, consider expanding the mulch or the ornamentals underneath the tree as much as possible. So kind of minimizing the grass is a good strategy. But the species you want to try to plant, and now is a good time to do that, are fine fescues. And there's a collection of them, creeping red fescue, chewings fescue, hard fescue. They're all best adapted for those shady situations. Now, be careful that you don't plant tall fescue. It sounds just like, you know, it ends in the word fescue, but it's way different and it's the wrong choice. So go with red fescue, hard fescue, chewings fescue, but do not plant tall fescue under that tree. But yeah, go ahead and try seeding those areas now with the fine fescues, and that's the best you can do.
Good luck, Sandy. Thank you so much. Patrick in Franklin emailed, and this is a common question. It's recommended that a pre-emergence crabgrass herbicide be applied in spring, not a fertilizer. However, he's only been able to find grass killer mixed with fertilizer at local garden centers. Wondering what he should do.
Yeah, that is a problem. Look, I would encourage you to keep looking. Look online. You can find online retailers that will sell just the crabgrass preventer. And again, the reason that we like to separate those two is the optimum timing's different. So crabgrass preventer now-ish is about right, but we won't want to start thinking about fertilizing until late May. So that's a pretty long time difference. So I would encourage you to check out more garden centers, ask about it specifically, and then go to online retailers if you can't find any there.
Yeah, I think some of the local garden centers might be better than some of the big box. You might have more luck.
More variety. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, you're going to have more variety at some of our really good locally operated centers. So there you go, Patrick. Thank you so much. Rick in Belleville, it's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Doug. Doug, I can't let you off the hook on crabgrass here. So I might have an answer to finding a pre-emergent. I've tried prodiamine. It's a pre-emergent, at least advertised as a pre-emergent crabgrass killer. But my question is, I've been told that the species is, I think, a Poa annua, which is supposedly an annual, which should respond to a pre-emergent. But someone else told me that there's a Poa perennial that will come up every year. I seem to not be able to. I'm having a kind of a issue. I can't seem to beat it back, even with the prodiamine. By the way, if prodiamine is the one you'd recommend, you can buy that in granules and mix it up online. So they should look for that. But I just wonder if there's a perennial crabgrass, and if Poa is the species. Maybe comment, if you could, on those issues.
Sure thing. Yeah, so crabgrass is a warm season annual, and then Poa annua is a cool season annual grass that likes shady, wet areas, and we can find it also in really high-maintenance lawns. And it's very, very closely related to some perennial Poa species, like rough bluegrass, which is Poa trivialis, and then Supina bluegrass, which is Poa supina. They look almost identical, except the Poa annua is an annual version. The other ones are perennials. And so if you do have one of those perennial, you know, a rough bluegrass or Poa supina, supina bluegrass, the pre-emergent is not going to stop them. And in that case, you would need to kill it with a non-selective.
What is prodiamine effective for what I'm dealing with?
So there's a couple of pendimethalin, prodiamine, and dithiopyr are the three conventional pre-emergent seed preventers. They'll prevent all seeds from germinating. It doesn't matter what it is. But for those perennial types, they're not germinating from seed. They're actually surviving from the previous year. Corn gluten meal is another will prevent all seeds from germinating.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much, Rick, for calling. I appreciate your call. Doug Soldat, our guest today, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison and lawn care expert extraordinaire. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jane Rotunda, our on-air producer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at spring turf care on the show today with our guest, Doug Soldat from the UW-Madison Department of Soil Science. Always great to have him come by and talk about your lawn and mine. And there's open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo, you can send it to ideas@wpr.org as well, and we'll get it on for you. In fact, Margaret sent an email. I don't know if you saw those email photos of her lawn, Doug?
Yes, I'm looking at them right now.
Yeah, these lines are on the north shady lawn after the snow melted and wondered what she's got there.
That is classic vole damage, vole with a V. I've never seen vole damage as bad as I have it in my yard this year. And I think it has a lot to do with how much snow cover we got. These things love the snow cover, protects them from the predators, and then they just tunnel underneath the snow on top of the lawn. They chew their way through, and they make these runways, which is the picture that Margaret shared. It'll take a while for those to heal up, but they should heal when the grass starts growing vigorously. An application of fertilizer will help. You can rake the material that they chewed away, but I wouldn't worry about it too much. It's really common, and like I said, particularly bad this year.
On to Jan in Viroqua. Hi, Jan.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
I have a large perennial garden in a rural area where there are a wealth of perennial wildflowers and plants that come up. And I'm going to tarp the areas where I'm actually planting perennials, but I'm wondering if there is a grass that's tough enough to fight perennials off that I could plant in between the row, in between my planting, so that I could grow grass and mow it instead of having to constantly battle with the perennials. I had done some research with a friend who knows a lot, and we were going to try chewing fescue, but it's definitely a full sun situation.
Hey, you got it. That's exactly what I was going to recommend. Chewing fescue it produces chemicals through its roots that keeps other plants out. Now, it may not be 100% effective, but it's going to be the most effective option for the situation that you described. So, yeah, find yourself some chewings, fine fescue, and see if that works.
Deb in Plymouth emailed, she's seen some beautiful photos of colorful thyme used, T-H-Y-M-E, thyme to replace grass. Wonders how difficult it would be to get this going in an established lawn.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I haven't worked with thyme in lawns. You know, it's definitely something that we've been playing around with more, and we're seeing clover put in mixes. And so, you know, people are starting to realize that having some plant diversity in those mixes is a good thing. And so, yeah, thyme is one that I don't have experience with, but you know, there should be some information online that that can help with getting a mix of species in your lawn. Yeah.
Yeah. John in Washburn County, we turn to you now. Hi, John.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Sure. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I killed off my lawn and overseeded with about 90% turf fescue, 10% blue. And overall, it's done okay, but I do think now it's a little thin at times. Maybe it's not quite as long, as lush as I'd like it to be. I should note that my soil is rather sandy up here. So my question is, what can I do to continue to promote growth and lushness? Do I just continue to overseed periodically every year to kind of thicken it up?
How do you fertilize?
You know, I'll probably throw some fertilizer down now, starting in probably end of May. I haven't obviously done any crabgrass preventer yet. And typically I get my my fertilizer from our local golf course, actually.
Okay. Yeah, so with tall fescue, it's the species that tends to do well in a lot of situations. It's tough grass. I would fertilize it at least twice a year if you're losing density, and then 3 times a year if you still aren't finding your desired density. What mowing height do you use? Can I ask that?
Doing it about 3 inches.
Yeah, so if you're losing density, you might want to bump that down to 2.5 and see if you start to see higher density. But it sounds like, you know, you're doing the right thing. Sandy soils can often be a little bit low in nitrogen, and so increasing the fertilizer when the yard starts to thin will move it in the right direction.
Yeah. You mentioned the cutting it shorter there. Kurt in Madison wondered, what's the optimal grass height for cutting typically?
Yeah, we've done research on this, and we've found between 2.5 and 3.5 is really optimal. You start to get below 2.5, and you start to see more and more weeds come in. Typically now, the lower you go, the higher density your lawn will be, but also the shallower the roots go, the more herbicides you might need to use. So 2.5 is kind of the low end of the sweet spot, and then 3.5 is good in other situations too.
Yeah, I cut about 3.5. Actually, I might even be 4, between 3.5 and 4.
Yeah, you know, in the way we say that, the top end is this, mow it as high as you can tolerate it, you know, as high as you can get away with and still accomplish your goals.
Well, Laura in Menominee Falls has a question for you, Doug. Let's go there. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Larry and Doug. Oh, this is wonderful. I love your show. I live in Menominee Falls, and I have clay soil in the front yard where it's mostly sunny. I have these little blue flowers and these little white flowers coming up. And as I'm going online, I'm seeing that there may be something invasive called spring scilla or something. But I like them. I just want to identify them.
Ooh, okay. Identifying things is hard over the phone. If you can send me an email with a picture of those plants, we can do our best to try to get them identified for you.
Yeah, or even if you've got some, just put them up, send them to ideas@wpr.org, and we could take a look, probably figure it out pretty quickly. There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Laura. Let's go to, let's see, Sharon in Green Lake County. It's your turn.
I think I'm your perennial advisor, Larry. I listen to you every Saturday or every Friday. love your show. I was going to detach my lawn. I have clay. I have very thick lawn. I always mow once a week, sometimes twice, and right to the end of the season. I have 3.5 inches. Okay, so I have not a residential expert. He's in Mississippi State, but at Blacksburg. But anyway, not Blacksburg. Well, anyway, where Mississippi State is. And I called him because I was going to thatch this spring. I haven't done it for about 5 years. And he said, do you fertilize your lawn or put any insecticides on it? And I said, no. He said, then you don't need to.
He's exactly right. Yeah.
He's exactly right. I bet your lawn looks just great, Sharon.
It does. It looks just wonderful. And I do try to keep it about 3.5, maybe later 3, but then he has to come. I have somebody come and do it because I'm an old lady. And it doesn't, I don't care if it looks wonderful at when it's tall, but it grows beautifully. And yes, I get crabgrass, but it loses out usually. And my nephew is a turfgrass management teacher, grad and undergrad at Mississippi State. And he's from Barron County, Wisconsin, and got his degree out at Virginia Tech. And my daughter said, well, why don't you ask your expert? And I said, well, who's that? The county? No, she said, Barry.
Barry. I know Barry. Barry Stewart down in Mississippi State. Sure. Yeah, no, well, he's right. So your lawn doesn't need to be dethatched if you're not. Usually when people say I need dethatching and they have thatch, it's because they're over-fertilizing. And so what you described is just proper lawn management. You likely don't have thatch, and so you can absolutely skip that and still expect good results from your lawn.
There you go, Sharon. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Carol in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Thank you very much for your program, Larry. I was speaking to a gentleman yesterday, and he said I should thatch my yard. I had already had plans to have the lawn aeration, that core or aeration, and he said that's really not any good. You want it thatched, and he was going to thatch it and put down lime. And my grass doesn't look like it used to years ago, certainly, and I just wonder what I should be doing. Is the core aeration a decent thing to do for your yard?
Core aeration sometimes can make a difference. It's definitely not something you need to do on an annual basis unless you have a lot of traffic. And so, if you have a small yard and you have a lot of activities on the yard or dogs that are running over, that core aeration can loosen the top inch or two of the soil and can help it, provide a better growing environment. But if your lawn's relatively low maintenance and it's, the only time it's getting used and when people are mowing it, you probably don't need to do that on an annual basis. And it's best done in the fall. And then so we've been talking about dethatching a lot in all program. And like I said, there's a lot of dethatching going on that doesn't need to happen. And if you do have thatch, which is a woody stemmy material that can be like an inch or inch and a half thick, you want to back off on your fertilization, and that'll also help take care of that thatch.
Yeah. Otherwise, you don't need it, Carol. Thank you very much for calling. Well, Kurt in De Pere, we'll go to you. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Larry. The problem I have is I have bent grass on the border of my property on three sides, and I killed it off and replanted 3-4 years ago, and it's back. Both parts.
Yeah,
it's coming in from the neighboring properties.
Yeah, bent grass is absolutely one of the toughest weeds to deal with. It likes these wet areas, has really shallow rooting, and it kind of pulls up almost like a carpet and turns brown when it gets hot and dry. And it reproduces by the way it creeps. It's called creeping bent grass, and that's how it reproduces. There's not much you can do. It's a continual battle. There is a product, a selective product called Tenacity, that you can apply. It takes multiple applications every 2 weeks apart. It's a relatively low impact chemical. It comes from the extract of the bottle brush plant, and it'll turn the bent grass white, and it won't kill the other grasses. So that's one option that you can use. The other option, of course, is just to do total renovation. Kill it with a non-selective herbicide and replant it. But it just keeps coming back, and it's just a battle.
Yeah. There you go, Kurt. Thank you very much for calling. You mentioned tall fescue earlier, and somebody emailed and said, how the heck do you get rid of tall fescue in the yard?
Yeah, there's no good options for that. Just like bent grass, the tall fescue is it's got a wider leaf blade. And so it gets mistaken a lot for quack grass and crab grass. And because it is a useful grass, we see more of it being put in seed mixtures. But if it's not, you know, the previous caller said, I had 80 or 90% tall fescue. That's a good mix. But if you're looking at a seed mixture and on the label it'll tell you what the percent of the different species in, if that tall fescue is any less than 80%, you don't want that seed mix. Otherwise, you get these little patches of this wider bladed grass, and the only way to get rid of it is to kill everything. You can spot treat it with a non-selective herbicide, but then you're going to get a brown patch that you're going to have to reseed or sod. So it's very, very difficult to take it out. There are no products you can apply that are just going to target the tall fescue. It's going to kill those. It'll just kill all the other grasses too.
Yeah. Is there a crabgrass preventer that will allow grass seed to grow? If he's fighting bare spots and crabgrass in the same place.
Yeah. So the only product I'm aware of is called Tupersan. And you can find that at garden stores, specialty stores. It will prevent weeds from germinating, but it will allow your grasses to come up. The other option is Tenacity, which is what I just recommended to the caller to kill the creeping bentgrass. That will, when you're seeding new patches, that's the product that we use. You can find it in certain starter fertilizers. They'll say starter fertilizer with Tenacity, and that will also allow turf grass seeds to germinate, but it will prevent crabgrass and other weeds from coming up.
You know, one area thing we haven't covered is lawn rolling, and Jason in La Crosse emailed, he and his wife are having a little battle over rolling their lawn. He doesn't believe it's necessary or good for the lawn. She wants the bumps and molehills gone. Is there a best way?
I've flip-flopped on this. I think if you go back to the archives, you'll hear me at one point saying, don't do it. And then I've just given up. And I said, go ahead and roll that lawn. Because so many people have, you know, they want that flat lawn. And you can rent a water roller. You fill it to a drum. You fill it with water. And you just go back and forth until those bumps are gone. Now, the reason I used to say don't do it is because you're compacting the lawn. But my trade-off here is if you're going to roll those bumps out in the fall, do me a favor and then hire a service to aerify the lawn, poke those little cores and loosen the compaction that you created in the spring. So that's my compromise. Go ahead and roll it in the spring, get everything flat, but then make sure that you do an aerification event in the fall to make sure that over time you don't create like a concrete surface.
Bill in Barneveld emailed and wondered if you've heard of the book Nature's Best Hope. It makes a strong case for the benefits for biodiversity of converting some of our lawns, which can be kind of considered biological deserts, into native plantings.
Yeah, I haven't read that book specifically, but of course, this is something we think about all the time. I just have a new graduate student now who's studying the biological diversity and the species richness and abundance of these landscapes. And certainly there are lawns that are true monocultures that are over-fertilized and over-treated. But there are other examples of lawns that have a lot of diversity. And there's studies that have been done on the soil microorganisms and the soil health. And, you know, one thing that lawns do is, and native plants certainly do this as well, is they add a lot of carbon to the soil, and microorganisms love carbon. And we also aren't tilling these lawns. So they're really interesting ecologically. And I kind of push back against the idea that all lawns are a sterile wasteland, which is sometimes things that you hear. There are definitely good ways to manage lawns. There's bad ways to manage lawns. But there's nothing inherently wrong with having a lawn as long as you care for it properly.
Yeah. Bill in Oregon emailed about milorganite. You brought that up earlier, too, a little bit. Is it a good nitrogen delivery for sandy soil? Is it it is non-burning, and the granules persist at the surface and slowly diffuse, of course.
Right, yeah. Milorganite was partially developed by O.J. Noor, who's our turf grass research station's named after, and he earned his PhD here at the University of Wisconsin in the 1920s. It's a great fertilizer. We at the O.J. Noor station, we test all kinds of different fertilizers, and Milorganite is certainly one that's performed well. It's an organic source of nitrogen that releases slowly and comes out of the city of Milwaukee. So it's definitely a product that we would recommend for those sandy soil situations for turf.
Let's take a call from Dennis in Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
I have a couple of things for things that were stated earlier. As far as bumps in a lawn, it could be from roots from evergreen trees and bushes. That's the problem I had. And the thing is, as far as over-fertilization, I wonder what the effects are of all the pesticides, herbicides, all the fertilizers that end up down in the groundwater. Then people, when they use their wells to water their lawns and their gardens, what effect that has.
Yeah, that's great stuff, and that's the thrust of the research that I do here at the University of Wisconsin, is we want to make recommendations that minimize or prevent the contamination of those natural sources. So when you look at our recommended fertilization and pesticide control strategies, they have that in mind. So we don't recommend fertilization practices that result in that contamination of the groundwater. So, for example, never apply phosphorus without a soil test showing the need. And most of the soils in Wisconsin have more than enough phosphorus. The nitrogen story, which is what we think about when we think about contaminated wells, is interesting too. Grasses are fertilized at maybe 25% of their nitrogen need. So if you do make two or three applications of nitrogen, that's actually a lot lower than the amount needed to maximize their growth. And if you put those down at the right time using slow-release nitrogen sources, the amount of leaching is very low, down in single digits, and often similar to the amount of nitrogen we see from unfertilized urban forested areas and natural urban landscapes. So we obviously care a lot about that and keep those things in mind when we're making these recommendations.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that question, Dennis, and comment. Lynn emailed us. Their lawn is sloping down from the road to the house and is under oaks, and jumping worms have invaded from the streets. So they experience gentle erosion. Over lots of years, there's not a real turf and superficial tree roots are growing up. What can she add? Lots of topsoil added gradually, maybe? Spread purple cow. They fertilize, but the soil is thin.
Yeah, again, that sounds like the growing grass under trees is difficult. Oak trees are some that where it can be possible. I would say consider the species that you're using, and you're going to have more success with species like Chewings fescue, hard fescue, red fescue, more so than Kentucky bluegrass, which is probably what you have. It's the most common grass. So transitioning to seeding those fescues, it will produce likely a thicker lawn. And like Larry alluded to, you go ahead and incorporate compost into the soil. That'll help the seeds germinate. It'll provide water and nutrient holding capacity and hopefully get that erosion under control.
Yeah. He mentioned jumping worms, and we had a show on that just recently, and a caller from Maple Bluff, I think, called in to say she had tons of jumping worms and actually started seeing a lot of short-tailed shrews, and apparently they love jumping worms. One of the few things that really seems to like jumping worms. And so the short-tailed shrews have been having a field day with the jumping worms, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely. That's good to hear. We need all the help we can get with those things.
Well, absolutely. Elizabeth in Verona, your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
So this is my first time. Hi.
Hi.
This is my first time being a homeowner and my first time taking care of my new lawn. It was just seeded last fall, and So it's there, or it's like inch or two now. But I don't know what to do, if I should be fertilizing, if I should be picking out the weeds. I don't know what to do.
Is it a brand new lawn? I mean, was it, you know, just a new construction, Elizabeth?
It was a completely new construction and just seeded last September.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. So, the two things that you hit on are things that we'd recommend. If you have a lot of weeds out there now, you can just walk along and pick them out by hand. There's some kind of weed pulling tools that exist on the market that are pretty cool if you have a ton of them. Fertilization, you should be thinking about sometime in mid-May around Memorial Day. And for a new lawn, that's going to be a really important thing to do. And probably three times a year, so Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, is going to help that establishing lawn thicken up and fill in all those areas and ultimately keep weeds from coming in. So one of the things we talk about for, you know, keeping weeds out of lawns is to keep the lawn thick using 2 to 3 fertilizer applications per year. And new lawns are, again, they're thin, so the weeds usually are pretty aggressive in the early parts. But you get growing that lawn well with fertilizer, keep it thick, and you should be on your way.
All right. Good luck, Elizabeth. Appreciate it. Well, should she be mowing and so forth? I bet she had a question about that, too.
Yeah, that's the most important thing you can do to your lawn. And like I say, some people won't do anything to their lawn, which is fine, but you should mow it with a sharp blade. So every year, get those, especially with new lawns, because you're probably going to be hitting rocks and, you know, and bumps and stuff early on. Keep a sharp blade, sharpen it every year, mow it high, 2.5 to 3.5 inches, and don't let the lawn get too thick before you mow it, because we found, our research has shown that actually has a big negative effect. Mow it as frequently as you can at a high height for the best quality.
All right. Good luck, Elizabeth, and with your lawn and with your new home. Appreciate your call. Well, Doug Soldat is our guest today, professor in the Department of Soil Science. We're talking with him about spring turf care. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, taking a look at your lawn today with Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. Great to have him back, and thank you for joining in. Ron in La Crosse has a question, so let's go there, maybe a comment too. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I have a couple questions. Years ago, I go back to the 1950s when I was just a little tyke, we used to have a lot of, I had two questions, we used to have a lot of white clover, and it seemed to be part of the seed mix when they first fertilized our lot. But nowadays, you don't see that. And the other thing is, decades before, back in the 50s, early 60s, when we get a cloudburst, a downpour, we used to get a lot of worms crawling out of the lawn onto the concrete. And, of course, once it stopped raining, they dried up, you know. So my question is, why isn't white clover in seed mixes? And what could be the reason I don't see worms crawling out after a heavy rainstorm?
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, white clover is making a comeback. There is a lot of interest in white clover Kentucky bluegrass mixtures, and you're exactly right. The original seed mixtures from Scotts contained white clover, and then we realized that we could make inexpensive chemical fertilizers, and we had these new herbicides that would kill weeds, and we decided it would be a good idea to provide the nitrogen with the chemical fertilizer instead of the natural nitrogen that clover provides. And, you know, in the last 10 years, we've started to realize that that's probably not a good idea, and we're starting to see interest in white clover. And so I have a study that's been in the ground now since 2011, where we have outstanding performance from a white clover Kentucky bluegrass mix, and Kentucky bluegrass alone with no extra fertilizer or herbicide looks terrible. So, and so 2 years ago, we've expanded our study, and we have all kinds of clover grass mixtures at the OJ North Station. So it's making a comeback. It's a good idea. It was a good idea back then. It's still a good idea. Micro clover is a smaller dwarf version of clover that we've been playing around with that works really well. And your question about the worms, I think is, I still see worms in my lawn and in my neighborhood. So I haven't seen data on declines in those species. And certainly we want to see worms. They aerate the soil, they move organic matter down, and they're generally good, good to have around. So hopefully we can continue to maintain lawns with that encourage a healthy soil ecosystem.
Yeah, and jumping worms aren't good for the other worms either. I guess there's research on that now, too. So if you have jumping worms, you're going to have fewer regular earthworms, I guess you could say.
Right.
Which is kind of too bad. Patricia in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Well, hello. Good to have you on the show, Doug. I have a lawn that was laid in 1967. Part of it is flat, part of it is lumpy, and I'm just wondering if there is a topsoil that I might use because I don't want to do a rolling of the lawn.
Yeah, that's a good question. You should be able to find local sources of topsoil in sort of bulk that you could spread on the lawn. You want to make sure that it is a high quality soil, that it should have a dark brown to black appearance. It should be crumbly in texture, so it shouldn't have a lot of clay in it. And then you can rake that across. So find a reputable supplier of a local topsoil would be one option. Another option that we've had good success with is finding a compost and spreading a compost across the surface. Basically, same qualification. You need to find a nice high quality source of that compost. But we put down about a quarter inch depth in the spring and the fall for 3 years, and we made dramatic improvements to a degraded urban lawn. So the most important thing is just find good quality material, make sure that it's a reputable supplier and that they have, soil tests that they can show you, and, make sure you're getting good stuff.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Patricia. Jeremy and Racine, your turn. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I have a dog, and then my son moved back home, and he brought his little rascal with him, and now my backyard has basically been at war of survival between the two animals. They seem to go in the same spots. What type of, maybe fertilizer, grass seeding that I could do that could be a little bit more resistant towards dog urine, and what other preventative things can I do to help reduce that? I'm like one step away from just building a massive litter box room.
Yeah, that. So it's really common problem. Probably right in the top two or three of the dog urine burn. There's not much you can do in terms of grass seed wise. There's differences in salt tolerance. So what's killing the grass is the salt concentration of the urine, but the differences in salt tolerance aren't great enough where I can tell you that this grass is going to resist it. So you hit on one of the top recommendations is train the dogs to pee in an area that's off the lawn, either in a mulch area or a rock landscaped area. That can be difficult to do, but it's probably worth the effort. What I do, I have a dog that does the same thing, is I have a 5 gallon bucket of topsoil, and then I rake up the dead area. I put that handful of topsoil down, and then I hand sprinkle some seed over the top, put a little more topsoil down, step on it really good. And the perennial, it should be a perennial ryegrass dominated mix that'll come up pretty quickly, and then slowly the Kentucky bluegrass that surrounds it will fill in those patches. So sort of the reseeding angle is what you can do for those dead spots. And then, like I said, I love trying to train the dogs to pee in a non-lawn area.
Get them in a back corner of the lawn. There you go, Jeremy. Thank you. Kathy in Oshkosh. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much, Larry. Is there a better way to plant around a retention pond about to be dug?
But when you say, is there a better way, do you mean like, is there something else to plant? Can you expand on that a bit?
Can you establish prairie around there?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, that's one of the things that we try to get out there is that you don't have to plant a lawn everywhere. Lawns have their value and their function, but we don't need to plant lawns everywhere. And so there's plenty of great prairie plantings and mixtures that you could use around a pond. I'm probably not the person to recommend the right mix, but certainly there are many places in Wisconsin that sell prairie mixtures that would be great around a pond.
Yeah, and it's a good time now because when you're building that pond, you're going to be scraping everything off and you're going to be getting rid of a lot of the weeds that may be an issue and might make it easier to get those prairie plants growing, I would think anyway. There's going to be a lot of disturbance, let's put it that way, when you're putting in a pond like that. I can tell you that from experience. Well, Doug Soldat is our guest today. Professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, his PhD in horticulture, specializes in all kinds of things, turf grass, urban soils, nutrient management, soil testing, and landscape irrigation. Always great to have him come by for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Doug Soldat, a professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. Always great to have Doug come by. If your lawn needs some help, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Sarah in Green Bay has a question for you. Doug, let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for taking my call. I have an area in my yard that is 10 foot by 10 foot that for the last 9 or 10 years has been a vegetable garden. And I had it bordered with 2x4s. In the last couple of years, the weeds have just gone out of control, and I've tried a variety of things. So I decided at the end of last summer that I'm no longer going to try a garden. I'm just going to go to the farmer's market. But now I need to do something and put to make grass grow there. And I'm wondering, how do I even get that started?
Ooh, I like this one, Sarah. A 10-foot by 10-foot area is something that I would be sodding.
Yeah, me too.
It's quick, it's immediate. The only thing you have to do is make sure it doesn't dry out. And if you do it early in the spring, you're less likely to run into any trouble there. So I would just prepare the soil, make sure you get it nice and level with the surrounding lawn, and usually like a quarter inch below, because the sod that you lay is going to have a bit of soil on it. Lay the sod down, keep an eye on it to make sure it doesn't dry out, and it should be easy peasy.
Yeah, and not too expensive either on 10 by 10. That is the quick and
made for sodding. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, made for sodding, for sure. Thank you. Jim in Madison emailed wondering what, and here's a question we get every time you're on, I think. What can we do to prevent creeping Charlie now or later?
Right. So most problems with creeping Charlie is shade. And so that's a plant that loves shade, does well in shade, and grasses, of course, struggle. So if you do have shade, it's going to be a constant battle. And we like to think about alternatives to grass in those areas. But if you happen to be in full sun, a properly timed herbicide application can eliminate it. And then if you keep your grass thick in the full sun, creeping Charlie will actually have a hard time invading again. So let's talk about timing for broadleaf weed control. The very best time is around the first hard frost. That's when the weeds will absorb the chemicals and down to the roots, and you get the most thorough kill. The second best timing is when they're flowering, which for ground ivy happens sometime in late May or early June. And so those two timings are when you want to think about controlling it. And like I said, even if you're even if you do it perfectly in the shade, it's going to keep coming back year after year because it outcompetes the grass in those situations.
Yeah. Hannah in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. So I live in the city of Milwaukee, and I currently live next to a city parking lot. But they're decommissioning the parking lot and selling it to us to, like, add on to our property. So it's currently concrete, and I was wondering what I need to do in terms of, like, soil testing or remediation or anything because it's been a parking lot for so long. And then also, like, once we do get the concrete up, I would like a low-maintenance, maybe, like, native plant sort of ground cover instead of doing, like, the monoculture bluegrass sort of thing. So I was just wondering if you had any advice for me.
Yeah, so that's good. You're going to, obviously, when you remove the concrete and the underlying gravel layer, you're going to have to bring in some topsoil. And so you want to make sure that you're getting topsoil from a high quality source that doesn't have a lot of weeds, that has a good amount of organic matter, and it's not high in clay. The companies that are selling the topsoil should have that information. And so make sure you're getting a high quality topsoil to fill in. They should have the soil tests, and the soil test should tell you how much phosphorus is in there. And that's the nutrient that we care most about when we're growing new grass from seed or new plants from seed. So assuming the phosphorus is high enough where you don't need to add any, then it's just a matter of selecting the right plants, plant mixture. And you have a lot of leeway there. I mean, we've talked about you can do a prairie mix, which you wouldn't mow. But if you do want to mow it, or if you have to mow it because of city regulations or something like that, there are low maintenance lawn mixtures with fine fescues. And like I talked about earlier, it'd be really nice to get some clover in there, which provides the nitrogen to the fine fescue and can make a really nice low maintenance area. So get a good topsoil and then make sure you're selecting a low maintenance plant mixture that suits your requirements.
There you go, Hannah. Thank you so much. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Srini in Verona emailed wondering, what's the best way to control the emergence of Japanese beetle grubs from the lawn? They have a serious problem every summer with the beetles destroying the rest of their landscape.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Beetles fly. The adults do a lot of damage on the ornamentals. And so even if you would control the grubs in your lawn, they're likely to find the ornamentals that they want to chew on anyway, just by flying. So the only reason I would control Japanese beetle in a lawn is if they're killing your grass. If your grass is has no roots and it turns completely brown and you can pull it up like carpet, that's white grub damage that you want to control. If you don't, if they're just chewing on your ornamentals, you know, you can consider putting out Japanese beetle adult traps at a high enough density to keep them off the ornamentals. But that can be difficult too. But controlling the grubs in your lawn is not necessarily going to keep them off of the ornamentals because, of course, they fly from all over.
Yeah. What's the best or easiest way to remove grass from a 4x9 vegetable raised bed short of digging up the lawn? Srini emailed that one too. So
the grass is growing in the raised bed, and they want to remove it without pulling it. Well, I guess you could cover it with a black plastic before you. You know, I'm not sure what kind of, if they have some perennial vegetables in there, it might be a problem. But smothering it is an option. You can use a non-selective herbicide to take it out again, but you have to be careful. I have to know more information about the situation to make the right recommendation, I think.
Yeah, I can see that problem. Tammy and Mason, your turn. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Happy Easter.
To you as well.
Okay, my question is, we got clay soil, and we want to have a good garden. I mean, like tomatoes and, you know, all your root vegetables as well. How can we do that? Is it the raised garden would be best?
Raised bed? Maybe a raised bed?
Yeah, that's a good option. If you have a soil that's high in clay, and you know, another option would be to amend your soil with compost. So mix up compost into your clay. That can be really difficult. So you know, raised bed where there's lots of different guides on the internet that'll teach you how to build them. But if you can just bring in a garden type mixed soil, then you don't have to worry about trying to make your clay work for you.
Yeah, and you probably need at least a foot to 18 inches on a raised bed.
Right.
Tomato roots get down pretty far, actually. Mm-hmm. So I'd cheat on the 18 inches side, but a foot at least, for sure. Dwayne in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. I just had... some lawn dug up because I needed to install some water and sewer laterals. And so what I did was smooth out everything and then put some soil down, a small amount, and put splinters, sprinkle some seeds down. And then I started to water it, and I'm not sure if that was the best thing to do, but I thought it shouldn't dry out on top, but perhaps did I do wrong, or what should I do to help this lawn get established again?
That was in the fall where you did that?
No, this is just the last few weeks.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you're good. Yeah, it's still too cold for that seed to come up. So I wouldn't worry too much about watering it or allowing it to dry out. In the spring, you know, generally when we put seed down, you don't want it to dry out, but there's just not a ton of evaporation going on right now. So I would say you're good. Just wait. Soil temperatures still need to get up into the 50s before that grass starts to pop. So I wouldn't say it's a failure yet, but it's just too cold for things to start moving.
We've got some photos and emails that we haven't covered yet that I kind of wanted to take a look at. If you can get your hands or your fingers to the computer there. Daniel and Nasita emailed in some photos. Healthy lawn growing under a shade tree, but recently that section of the lawn has grown sparse. A lot of black mounds appearing amongst the sparse grass last April, May. Noticed a lot of worms congregating there at night.
Right. Yeah, so this kind of goes back to the caller saying they don't notice a lot of earthworms, and here what we're looking at is earthworm castings that are covering the lawn. And so this lawn has a lot of earthworm activity. The thinning out of the lawn is not likely related to the earthworms. It's just the earthworm castings are visible on the surface because the grass isn't very thick, and the grass isn't very thick because there's shade there. So you know, what I like to do, especially right under trees, is consider just expanding the mulch circle where it's so hard for the grass to compete. The grass in the picture here, I can tell, is Kentucky bluegrass, which is the worst option for shaded areas. So I would look into chewings and hard fescue, red fescue, if you want to try to reseed these thinner areas. But I wouldn't worry about the worms. Assuming these are earthworms, they're kind of tilling the soil and moving nutrients around. And the fact that you can see them is just because your lawn is thin because of the shade there.
And down the line here, Dell in East Dubuque emailed in a couple of photos wondering what type of grass seed would survive with the least damage from winter snow. Currently, they replant the area every year with a blended grass. The result is they get some grass along with crabgrass and weeds. The spread pelletized gypsum on the area, they spread that to counteract the damage from the salt that the township applies. And then right on a corner there, the way it looks.
That, I'm looking at that. That is intense and really classic salt burn. And just like the answer to the dog urine question, it's when the salt concentrations are that high, species selection isn't going to make a difference. And so there's not a good answer to that. The amount of salt from the side of the road there that's getting put on that landscape is overwhelming the plants, and no matter what you plant, you're going to have trouble. I think it's a conversation with the city or the municipality about where they're applying that salt could be the right way. I don't have a good lawn solution to you. That to me, that looks like you're going to have to renovate that every year.
Yeah. Margaret in Stoughton couldn't stay online, but was wondering about red clover. You were talking about white clover earlier. Can you talk about red clover in a lawn?
Yeah, so we've been evaluating different types of clover, strawberry clover, red clover, white clover. What we've found is the white clover is the most, I want to say aggressive. Don't take aggressive the wrong way, like it's invasive, but we get better results with the white clover than we have with the strawberry and the red clover. But certainly we do get good mixtures with red clover and strawberry clover as well. So, and there's many other legumes. We just haven't evaluated them all. So white clover appears to be one of the better options, but there are certainly more than just that species that you could try.
Patrick emailed, he uses pelletized gypsum to repair the lawn from urine damage from her dogs or his dogs. He says pelletized gypsum will also repair soil salt damage from roads and driveways self-applied in winter. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so I would agree with it from the road salt. So there's two issues with salt. One is just the total salt concentration being too high. And actually gypsum is a salt. So in the kind of the agricultural chemistry world, salt is just something that's going to dissolve in water. It's not necessarily table salt. There is a specific negative problem associated with sodium. Sodium makes soils swell up and not drain well. And when you have too much sodium, applying gypsum, which is calcium sulfate, will get rid of the sodium. But in terms of the dog urine, that's a salt issue that's not associated with sodium. And so gypsum shouldn't really help that. There might be a bit of a placebo effect there. But when you do have road salt, it has sodium in it, the gypsum will help improve the soil properties, but it won't do anything to prevent the grass from dying because of the overload of the high salt concentration.
Okay. Mark from Wauwatosa emailed and says, in southern Wisconsin, when is the earliest time to sow grass seed to fill spots in on an established lawn?
Right. So right about now is probably the first time that I'd start thinking about, yeah, we could put some seed down. The grass seed won't actually start to germinate and come up until the soil temperatures get into the 50 range. I just looked at my weather station this morning in Madison. Soil temperatures are in the mid to upper 40s. So it doesn't do you a lot of good to go out very early. The grass seed's just going to sit there. And so about the time soils get into the 50s, which is happens about early to mid-April, is when you want to start thinking about seeding in the spring.
Luke in Watertown emailed, what's the best way to add compost to your lawn? Should you water it into the lawn or rake it into your lawn or something else, some combination?
Yeah, that's great. I just rake it in. So, spread it around in a however you can do that with a scoop shovel. And you want to rake it to the point where you can see a mixture of compost and grass. You don't want to smother the grass or you can't see any grass, but you want to be able to see some of the compost on the surface. And I found a leaf rake works really good for moving that compost around until you get that desired density.
Yeah, and doesn't that, you used to recommend that as well for when bumps or holes in the lawn. if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of my favorite things. So if you have a lawn where you could, where the size of it, when you don't just, you know, freak out about having to think about raking compost over the entire lawn, it's a good strategy. So compost does a lot of things. It improves the soil, it adds nutrients, it holds water, it smooths out the surface. I love putting compost on lawns, but the major limitation is the amount of work that's involved.
Sandy emailed, she and her husband found that watering the area soon after the dogs do their thing helps minimize the damage. The grass has come up even better in those spots.
Yeah, right. Because so the salt in the urine, the salt in the urine that kills the grass is nitrogen. So if you take a handful of nitrogen fertilizer and you put it down on your grass, you'll get a spot that looks just like a dog urine burn. So that, you know, that's another thing I guess I didn't mention when we talked about the dog pee, is you want to dilute it. You want to add water, but a lot of times it's difficult to get out there right behind the dog every time. So, yep, that absolutely works. And the greening you see is because the salt has been diluted and the nitrogen concentration then is being able to be used by the grass.
We had a lot of questions about the no-mo, and you've talked about this no-mo or low-maintenance lawns, and we do get a lot of questions about it. What's the department? Talk a bit more about the research going on those options.
Yeah, so there's it's confusing because there's a lot of marketing that goes on with low-mo, no-mo. But the species that are in those mixtures are the same ones we've been promoting for a lot of situations all program, and that's the chewings, fine fescue, the red fine fescue, and hard fine fescue. Those are the components that they're fine fescue, collection of species that do well in a variety of situations. And you know, they do great. The when they do poorly though is under traffic. So if you have to use your lawn a lot, it doesn't like that. In 2012, there was all kinds of dead fine fescue because it couldn't handle the heat and the drought that we experienced in the state that year. But other than that, if you have a relatively low traffic lawn, fine fescues, chewings, hard, creeping red, strong creeping red, slender creeping red, those are great options. Just be careful that you're not putting down tall fescue. Because it's a completely different species and will behave differently. So for those fine fescues, low-mo, low-maintenance grasses, chewings fine fescue, hard fescue, and red fescues are the best options.
Do they stick those tall fescues in with some of those fine fescues?
Yeah, sometimes they do. It drives me crazy. They sneak them in there. I mean, tall fescue is a great grass on its own. It has its own merits, but it needs to be the dominant species. You don't want to mix tall fescue in with anything else other than 10 or 20% Kentucky bluegrass. So it should be 80 to 90% tall fescue. And I see a lot of mixtures with 30% tall fescue. And I just say, no, why would you do that? That's the worst idea.
Well, the best lawn I've seen so far is the field at American Family Field. It used to be, it was Miller Park. I turned on for a couple of seconds to watch the baseball game yesterday with the Brewers and the Twins, and their grass looks really good.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's Kentucky bluegrass, and they mow it short. And it's cared for, you know, immaculately. But, you know, the number one problem they have with that is the shade. And so in the last several years, they've brought in artificial lighting, which has made that grass perform so much better. So Kentucky bluegrass hates the shade. That site's got a lot of shade from the seats and the roof. So they have to bring in lights.
Doug, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. I look forward to another visit from you. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Larry.
Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us for Garden Talk. Monday, we'll talk about a new podcast from Wisconsin Humanities and then a new novel, Raft of Stars. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.